Costa Johnson and I met many times to document and discuss various aspects of the Hoglund case. Costa was not a naive New Age ufologist but a down-to-earth person in spite of his deep involvement with this most complicated contact story. Because of his friendship with Richard Hoglund, he was entrusted with more data of his experiences than anyone else. In this blog I will present some interview transcripts and the unique insights and theories Costa related to me. Some of the data was documented in my book on the Hoglund case, but much of this is new information. A short while after his first encounter with the aliens on November 9, 1965, Richard Hoglund contacted a representative of the Ufological Society, and that led to the initial meeting between Costa Johnson and Richard. They soon became friends as Costa helped the Hoglund couple, Richard and Gunvor, to find an apartment in Osmo, south of Stockholm. This was after their first trip to the Bahamas in March 1967, when no contact occurred as Richard had forgotten to bring the metal plate it had received from the aliens. Thicken, did you see the plate yourself? Costa, no, but he made a drawing of it which I received from Ster. It had these Adamski signs. But he suffered from the plate. He got rashes and it also emitted so much heat he had to have it wrapped up in asbestos. Usually he kept it buried in the soil. I felt like a prophet when I received the plate, he once told me. The plate given to Richard by the aliens. Hakan, when you phoned Richard, did you always hear those strange clicks you mentioned? Costa, no, it was during the last years. Ster confirmed this also. When the clicking started, Richard became very nervous and suggested we stop the conversation. Once it continued clicking after I hung up and the phone rang. I answered and a voice said, "It is wrong." This same voice had entered the conversation several times before. I am convinced his phone was tapped. Richard told Costa that he now and then was fetched by one of their craft and they traveled to the alien base in Bahamas and later Mexico. He could be gone for a month at a time. When Costa met him again, he was suntanned. Richard parked his car at a secret place where he was picked up by the aliens. The craft was semi-translucent but not large enough for him to stand up. He was rather secretive about his activities at the base. But on the third trip to the Bahamas, the last time with his wife and the traveled by plane, Richard wrote to Costa January 11, 1969, "We have a good time here, my wife and I. Food, money, cigarettes, liquor all free, but we are required to do things also. I hope that one day I can tell you why we are here, but now it is impossible. We have our own car, a large black Cadillac, but you must understand we are under a certain form of control." In a later letter, January 16, 1969, Richard wrote, "I cannot disclose what we are doing here, but I can reveal that it is a sort of school we attend, and then you understand that the teachers are interplanetary. I have no idea how long we will remain here. Those who have hurt us will be punished, but you can be calm." Richard Hoglund in Nassau, Bahamas. Both Richard and his wife Gunvor met the aliens on the third trip to the Bahamas. It was in a villa outside Nassau. The black Cadillac is interesting as he mentioned this already in 1967, before the men in black lore became well known. According to Richard, the Cadillac was an old model but looked brand new. He had some trouble driving it at first. It was impossible to collide with this car as it had a sort of magical eye. Hakan, how did the aliens look? Costa, they were brown, like suntanned, thin, dark eyes, long fingers. Only once did he notice something defective in their bodies. It was a man with a scar in his head. There were no women among them and they didn't sleep or eat but drank, even liquor, and smoked. They could disappear into thin air. He told me that once he had been sitting chatting with two aliens on a bench in the Bahamas when some people approached them. He felt so ashamed because he was suddenly talking into thin air. The aliens were simply gone. Hakan, did he take any pictures in the Bahamas? Costa, yes, I have seen several. When he tried to photograph them, only a square light was visible in the picture. There was a black man, Loftin, there at the same school. He showed me a photo of himself and Loftin. They became good friends. Lofton turned out to be a CIA agent and he was later found on Little Exuma with a hole in his head. After this incident, Bahamas was swarming with CIA agents and they had to move their base to Mexico. Lofton had obviously revealed the base, so he was shot, executed. Richard didn't regard them as especially intelligent. When he asked something, they never answered directly but asked their superiors and came back with the answer next time. Richard with his friend Lofton in the Bahamas. Richard Hoagland is unusual in contactee history as he didn't trust the aliens but felt forced to work for them as they had cured his kidneys. Richard once told Goster that they were totally insensitive to humans, have no high morals. We are like domestic animals to them. My wife believes she has met the angels of God, but I don't think so. Richard Hoagland died in 1977. He became convinced that the aliens he worked for were dangerous and warned Goster to not have anything to do with them. So what really happened to Richard and his wife? In my book Framlinga Parvajord, Aliens on Earth, I propose 5 theories. 1. Real contact with aliens. 2. A cover for espionage. 3. Organized crime. 4. Fraud to make money. 5. Pathological lying. Whatever the truth behind the claims of Richard Hoagland, he definitely was involved with some secret group and activity, and he traveled to Bahamas and other countries. His life is an intriguing mystery. Empirical evidence in the Richard Hoagland case. In the American magazine UFO Report 1977, John Keel wrote a very interesting article, The Contactee Key, presenting some of his conclusions and advice from several years of field investigation. He noted the great mistake made by the early UFO organizations, APRO and NICAP, in regarding all contactees as hoaxers and consequently missing a lot of valuable data. Had these groups applied some fundamental logic to the situation, they might have realized their approach was wrong. By publicly dissociating themselves from the contactees, the early ufologists left this fruitful aspect entirely in the hands of the government. UFO Report, Volume 4, Number 4, August 1997. What John Keel discovered during his field investigations was that some contactees were actually genuine and did encounter visitors from somewhere, and that this aspect of the UFO enigma required a different approach than ordinary mainstream UFO research. Jacques Vallee, in his Messengers of Deception, let the character Major Murphy define this problem facing ufologists: what makes you think UFOs are a scientific problem? Science has certain rules. For example, it has to assume that the phenomenon it is observing is natural in origin rather than artificial and possibly biased. Now, the UFO phenomenon could be controlled by alien beings. If it is, added the Major, then the study of it doesn't belong in science. It belongs in intelligence. Meaning counter-espionage. P. 68. During my many years of contactee investigation, I discovered that in a few FISEAL contactee cases there was independent or circumstantial evidence that the contactee really was meeting strangers, whoever they were. Luzenstag found this out regarding George Adamski, and ufologist Ted Blocher changed his mind on contactees when he discovered a similar situation in the Woodrow Dierenberger case. Based on these experiences, what I find rather frustrating in mainstream UFO research, at least in Sweden, is the large amount of time spent by field investigators on ordinary UFO observations and misidentifications. In my view, a complete waste of time and money that will never solve the UFO enigma. I have for years tried, without much success, to convince active ufologists in Sweden to forget misidentifications and reports with very little empirical data and concentrate 100% on close encounters and contact cases. My advice is, as ever, try to be more of a UFO detective or intelligence agent than investigator of lights in the sky. One of the most intriguing and complicated UFO contacts I have ever investigated is the Richard Hoagland case, summarized by Timothy Good in his latest book Earth, An Alien Enterprise. I will not repeat the summary here, as you can find the case here and on several of my blog entries. But I would like to give a few details of the circumstantial evidence indicating a genuine contact. Richard Hoagland. 1. Disappearance of kidney stones. Richard claimed to have been healed from his kidney troubles with an instrument placed on his back during the first contact on December 9, 1965. The pain left him instantly when the alien visitor held an instrument to his back. There were X-rays taken both before and after this incident. I received written statements from three medical doctors involved with the X-rays. They confirmed that no stone was visible on the plates after December 9, 1965, but there is a possibility that the stones could have left the body in a natural way. According to one of the doctors, Karl-Erik Swenson, the later plates after the incident seems to indicate a man who never had any kidney stones. 2. Telephone interference. Two of Richard's friends, Gosto and Sturgeonson, many times experienced strange telephone problems talking to Richard. Often when Sturgeonson called Richard on the phone, the line was broken and a harsh voice simply said, "It is wrong," always the same voice. Sometimes when talking on the phone, a clicking sound was heard, and then Richard became very nervous and wanted to end the conversation. Once the clicking sounds could be heard after the conversation had ended and the phone was dead. Then a call came, and when Gosta answered, the same voice only said, "It is wrong." Gosta Johnson was convinced that Richard's phone was tapped. 3. Invisible entities. Once on the Bahamas, Richard was sitting on a bench talking with one of his alien visitors. Some people are passing by, and suddenly Richard finds himself talking aloud alone, and the visitor is gone. He felt very embarrassed of the situation. Obviously, the aliens could make themselves invisible. In the beginning of the 1970s, the couple Sturgeonson and Tara Johnson become involved with Richard's activities. On a Monday evening around midnight, when the couple have gone to bed, Richard is awakened by the sound of their front door opening and someone walking around with heavy steps in the apartment. Believing she has forgotten to lock the door, Richard goes up only to find the door closed and no one there. She goes to bed again, and then the heavy steps are heard once more, like someone is walking around in the rooms. She wakes up her husband. They look for some intruder to no avail, and after a while no footsteps are heard. During a telephone conversation with Richard a few days later, Tarad mentioned the name Vada Cartino, the name of one of the alien visitors. Richard answers, "Yes, he was here for 3 days and he visited you one evening and said you had a nice apartment." Then Richard gives a detailed description of Stur and Trid's apartment, although he had never been there. Richard Hoglund in Nassau, Bahamas. 4. Travels. Richard was often gone from home, sometimes for months. He claimed that the space people picked him up in their craft, often visiting the base hidden in the Bahamas and also Mexico. Richard complained once to Gosta Johnson that he was not allowed by his contacts to visit the Olympic Games in Mexico in 1968. Gosta noticed that sometimes in the middle of the winter he found Richard with a deep suntan when he returned to Sweden. Richard was a retired rock blaster with very little money. He couldn't have gone on regular flights around the world based on his meager income. 5. Gunvor Hoglund's Bahamas encounter. Richard's wife Gunvor was not allowed to participate in the meetings with the alien visitors, but she observed them many times when they came to their home. But once, at a restaurant in Nassau, Bahamas, she was introduced to one of Richard's contacts. It was a small and crowded premise. Richard recognized one of his contacts and they came to our table. I watched this man and he looked at me. He had a brown suit, a sort of suntan, not very tall and rather thin, a southern look in appearance. And he wasn't very tall. My God, I thought, your suit is too large. He greeted me but we didn't shake hands. His gaze was very intense and hypnotic. He smoked and left the rest of the cigarette on the table and then went away. I saved the cigarette butt as evidence. 6. Reluctant contactee. Richard was a reluctant contactee. He was given no message but ordered to start a peace movement in Sweden. This failed and he was reprimanded because other contactees had succeeded in founding organizations that made a lot of money. Richard didn't trust the alien visitor followers, fictional story as a result of drug abuse, mystic visionary experiences with no physical evidence, the contactee a mental case, myth maker or fantasy prone personality. During one period, Richard's friends, Sturr and Tara Johnson, speculated that because of his many travels, he was a courier in the international drug trade, but they later came to accept his contacts as genuine. When ufologists become involved in contactee cases like this, the advice and experiences of John Keel and Jacques Vallee will prove invaluable. This is a world very different from investigating and documenting misinterpretations of Venus and airplanes. The fantastic world of Johnny Lindell. During my many years of investigating and documenting contactee cases, I have met a wide assortment of personalities, most of them sincere mystics with diverse forms of inner experiences. There has also been the usual cadre of drug addicts, compulsive liars and fantasy-prone personalities. A few, a very few, intriguing cases of physical contact claims are still unresolved and remains a riddle to me. One of these is the Richard Hoagland case, which I documented in Aliens on Earth. UFO contacts in Sweden. A summary of the Hoagland experiences was presented by Timothy Good in his latest book Earth, An Alien Enterprise. Richard Hoagland claimed that on his second contact with the aliens, in August 1966, he was given a small metal plate with unknown script and ordered to go to their base in the Bahamas. He was told to always wear this plate on all his contacts and travels. Sometimes the plate became so hot he had to keep in asbestos. Other times it gave him rashes. This reminds me of the controversial Albert K. Bender, who also claimed he received a small metal from his men in black. He mentions in Flying Saucers and the V-Men, p. 93, that his metal sometimes got so hot I had to drop it. Richard showed the metal plate to his wife Gunva Hoagland, who affirmed its existence when I interviewed her several times. She also mentioned that once at the Bahamas, Richard was so fed up with working for the aliens that he threw the plate on the floor, exclaiming, "To hell with all of this." This same evening the aliens showed up at their apartment and he was given a sharp reprimand for his behavior. Gösta Johnson was one of Richard Hoagland's very few friends and one of the primary sources during my many years of documenting this case. He also received a copy of the signs on the plate. In January 1968, Gösta happened to meet the famous stage magician Johnny Lindell on a parking place south of Stockholm, and as he knew Johnny was interested in UFOs, Gösta showed his copy of the signs on the metal plate and explained that he didn't know what was up or down in the script. Without any hesitation, Johnny said, "You start reading here," and then he pulled out his business card and wrote down something with similar script, signing the message ZZ, which was the initials for his stage magician Nami Zania's Emona. But he also said, "There are a few dots missing here. Either it has been copied carelessly or there is some other fault." According to Johnny, the plate was a sort of identification card and the signs represented mountains and rivers. Later Gösta Johnson showed the message written by Johnny to Richard Hoagland, who said, "Yes, we know of this writing. We have interpreted it fairly well, but there are a few dots we don't understand." Johnny Lindell was not only a famous stage magician but also claimed to be in contact with aliens and working for them. He had his own metal plate received by the aliens. The Swedish psychometric medium Anna Light tested Johnny's metal plate in 1967 by holding it in her hand. According to Gösta Johnson, she received such a shock that she fainted. When she woke up, she said, "This was the most gruesome thing I have ever held. There is a mafia connected to this metal. If Johnny tells me to work for him, I will have no alternative." According to Johnny Lindell, the aliens he was involved with were really a form of mafia. There were two extraterrestrial mafia groups operating on Earth. One was called Brothers of the Axe and the other Zed. The ordinary Earthbound mafia had to pay their money. All this was probably pure fantasy by Johnny, but a fascinating coincidence is that Richard and Gunva Hoagland, for a short while in the 1960s, really worked in the home of Mr. Lou Chesler in Nassau, Bahamas, having been hired by the Swedish businessman Hans Bratt. Chesler was the front man for famous organized crime figure Meyer Lansky. So who was Johnny Lindell? With good help from Krista Nielsen of Sveriges Magi Arkiv, the Swedish magic archives, and documents from AFU, I have been able to ascertain a few facts. Johnny Lindell, 1922, 1979, became fascinated by stage magic already in school. He began a professional career as a stage magician, entertaining audiences with spectacular magic tricks. For many years he regularly performed for the Swedish royal family at Christmas. He toured in Sweden and several European countries and also showed his talents on Swedish television. Johnny Lindell was married two times and had three daughters. Johnny Lindell, 1963. In 1984 I interviewed one of his old partners, Anne Marie Johnson. She was a motorcycle acrobat, and between 1958, 1963 they had a show together including stage magic. Anne Marie hired Johnny for the show, and for several years they traveled together, and during these years she came to know him quite well. Anne Marie didn't know what to think of all the stories she heard from Johnny. He claimed to have been in the Himalaya meditating, but also having been a member of the French Foreign Legion. She believed this to be true as he showed her documents from his involvement. He told of having witnessed a UFO landing in the USA and to be in contact with aliens. Anne Marie believed some of his stories to be fantasies or exaggerations, but she sometimes experienced a nasty or wicked aura or radiance from him. The Swedish ufologist Krista Jansson was a good friend of John Lindell. They were both members of Ufologiska Sällskapet, the Ufological Society, in the 1960s and spent many evenings together, where Johnny told of his involvement with an alien group called Zeta. When I interviewed Krista Jansson in August 1986, he mentioned that Johnny openly told him that not everything he said was the truth. Johnny Lindell was a member of UFO Sweden until his death in 1978. He was active in the UFO group Solna Astronomiska Forening, SAF, and sometimes performed his magic tricks during meetings. On December 1, 1976, Johnny Lindell was interviewed in the local newspaper Södernyheterna as a representative of UFO Sweden. To the journalist he stated, "There is a lot of evidence. We have no idea where they come from, but they are real, that is for sure." There were several people who were afraid of Johnny Lindell and his strange tales. Psychometric medium Annie Likes believed he worked for some mafia organization, and he told one of his friends he was involved in the gambling and porn industry. Swedish contactee Rickard Hoglund said Johnny was evil. It is hard to determine what was the truth or fiction in the fantastic world of stage magician Johnny Lindell. He was a fantasy-prone personality and also a riddle. Reluctant contactees. The classic image of the UFO contactee is a rather naive individual claiming physical or telepathic contact with extraterrestrials and absorbed in spreading a spiritual message of peace and love, combined with dire warnings of coming catastrophes. But there are a few rare exceptions to this rule in contactee history. One of these exceptions is the extremely complicated physical contact case of the Swedish rock blaster Richard Hoglund, 1913. 1977, which I spent many years investigating and documented in Aliens on Earth. UFO Contacts in Sweden. A summary of this case was presented by Timothy Good in his latest book Earth, An Alien Enterprise. Richard Hoglund was a reluctant contactee. During his first contact experience, he claimed his kidneys had been healed by a group of aliens, and because of that he, from the beginning, felt compelled to work for them in various international schemes. Richard traveled to their bases in Bahamas and Mexico during his active involvement with the alien group between 1965-1977. But he differed from the ordinary contactee in that he was very doubtful regarding their true motives and noted that their morals were not very high. Richard was actually afraid of these aliens and didn't always believe what they told him. "I don't know if they are gods or devils," he once told his friend Gösta Johansson. He didn't dare stop working for them, and towards the end of his life he told my ufologist colleague Ek Franzen to beware of this group as they were dangerous. Whatever happened to Richard Hoglund, circumstantial evidence clearly indicates that he was involved with some secret group, whether a spy organization, international mafia or alien Earth-based group. Another reluctant contactee is Enrique Castillo Rincon from Costa Rica. His experiences are documented in UFOs. A Great New Dawn for Humanity from 1997. In the preface he states, "I'm not a mystic nor a religious fanatic. Neither have I considered myself a chosen one to save humanity, and I detest those contactees who pretend to have been appointed by some divinity to carry some message to the suffering and almost disgraced human race. Over 20 years have passed and I still don't know why I was contacted. Was it plain chance? Why was an individual belonging to the sandwich class, middle class, such as myself, assigned such an ungrateful task as this one, which has meant jeers, calumnies, epithets, and nicknames against my person and my dignity?" The experiences of Enrique Castillo Rincon differs from those of Richard Hoglund in that they are basically of a positive nature, but Rincon is still very puzzled of what it all meant and who the aliens actually were. One of the chapters of his book is named The Venusians. Are they Venusian? As with Hoglund, the contacts are very physical and involves the classic aliens among us theme. Enrique's meet a businessman, Cyril Weiss, of Swiss nationality, and they become friends. Later he encounters this man aboard a UFO, as he actually belongs to an advanced group of extraterrestrials trying to help Earth. Enrique is given this information: "From antiquity, we have contacted other men, belonging to various cultures. We have influenced their thinking through what you call masters. But not only on this planet, also on others, we have contributed to their scientific, cultural and spiritual development. Besides, some of us have been born here, or incarnated, if you prefer, since ancient times. We do not explore your planet, because we have had bases here for thousands of years. We belong to an organization that gives assistance to the planet, and we have always been present." Anyone acquainted the esoteric tradition as represented by H.P. Blavatsky or Alice Bailey will immediately recognize the ideas and philosophy given by the aliens. Enrique is also taken to a secret spiritual retreat in the Andes. The organization mentioned by the aliens is working like a secret intelligence group on Earth. Enrique is given secret code keys to be used to identify agents of the organization, but also as a protection against the opposition. Whether it is the opposition or a real intelligence group, in 1974 Enrique is contacted by three foreign-looking individuals offering to take him to Washington, D.C., all expenses paid, for a test in regressive hypnosis. He accepts the invitation. Outside, two men were waiting with a luxurious, dark-colored Cadillac. "I started feeling like a star in a suspense movie. 113. After this visit to Washington, D.C. and interrogation, Enrique has several doubts. What were the true identities of those obscure agents who could take me and return me to Bogota, with arrangements made with a complete network of people, also well coordinated? What were their true motivations?" 119. Compare this visit with the Alden Moore case of 1957, documented by NICAP and the UFO evidence, or the rather fantastic claim of psychic Ingo Swann in his book Penetration. "Based on my experiences on contactee research in Sweden, I regard it as a definite possibility that there are some form of aliens operating behind the scenes on this planet. To seriously consider such a wild conspiracy theory is perhaps not in line with mainstream scientific ufology, but I am more concerned about the truth than keeping a facade of respectability. Whether this theory is valid or not can only be answered by more open-minded investigation." Finally, Enrique Castillo Rincon had this to say regarding his contact experiences: "It is my belief that I am the only contactee in the world who does not have a mission to accomplish. They never, I repeat, never made me responsible for such an assignment. It was I who decided at the right moment to tell the world about what had happened. I became the investigator of my own experiences and compared mine to those of other very famous and well-known contactees. A few days ago I watched a documentary on the life of John F. Kennedy. In a speech in Dublin on June 28, 1963, he said, 'The problems of the world cannot possibly be solved by skeptics or cynics, whose horizons are limited by the obvious realities. We need men who can dream of things that never were, and ask why not. Perhaps with a touch of hubris I couldn't help making an association to AFU and our dream of creating the largest UFO/Fortean archive in the world, which is now a reality. What is left is solving the UFO enigma. Definitely a challenge of different proportions.